from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A Freedom Flotilla delivering aid to the hard-pressed people of Gaza was condemned by the Israeli government. RT's Rory Suchet has more.
Pro-Palestinian activists from Sweden and Norway have boarded a trawler in Gothenburg, and they are heading straight for Gaza. The ship is carrying humanitarian aid, medical equipment, and solar panels, and is part of a flotilla of three, which is aiming to break Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip with non-violent action. Israel, meantime, quick to condemn the flotilla as an unnecessary provocation. Israel says it will not allow any ship to pass. Well, Israel's response to this humanitarian mission will be closely watched. 5 years ago, you may remember, 10 Turkish activists trying to reach Gaza and deliver aid were killed by Israeli commandos who boarded their vessel. Those actions sparked an international outcry, but Israel insisted its troops justifiably acted in self-defense, protecting themselves and protecting their country. Well, activists trying to reach Gaza say the blockade is illegal and inhumane. It must be broken as soon as possible. Over a decade, Israel has imposed a number of restrictions on Gaza, strangling off the delivery of goods and tourism in and out of the Strip. In 2006, when Hamas came to power, restrictions were broadened to become a full-scale blockade. A year later, the sanctions were made even more severe. As a result, the situation in Gaza remains dire. We spoke to one activist involved in aid flotillas. He says the international community must work to put more pressure on Tel Aviv.
Our goal and purpose is to break the siege of Gaza. The international community that should work hard and should pressure Israel to lift this illegal blockade that have been there over 8 years and have not led to other than suffering of the Palestinian people in Gaza. The Gaza is the port of Palestine. Gaza is the window and the door of Palestine to the world. So it's our task as citizens of the world to show our government that we don't accept this situation. We don't accept that 1.5 million people are in kind of a outdoor prison and nobody cares. We care and we are going to do everything we can to show that we care. The Israelis who are breaking international law, we are not breaking anything. If we break anything, we're breaking an illegal siege.
On Wednesday, the Vatican announced that it would soon sign a treaty recognizing the state of Palestine, adding weight to an intense Palestinian push for international support for sovereignty that bypasses the paralyzed negotiations with Israel. Protests against the planned execution by Saudi Arabia of a prominent Shia cleric. We have this report from RT.
Protests have broken out in Saudi Arabia over the planned execution of Shia cleric and opposition leader Namir Bakir al-Namir. People took to the streets to call for clemency, demanding his immediate release after more than 3 years in prison. Al-Namir was sentenced to death after he took part in protests during the so-called Arab Spring of 2011. But just who is the cleric? And why do authorities see him as a threat? First and foremost, he's known for his outspoken criticism of the ruling family in Saudi Arabia. He helped lead anti-government protests in 2011 and was later found guilty of seeking, quote, foreign meddling in the kingdom's affairs and disobeying authorities. In October 2014, al-Namir was sentenced to death, a decision criticized by Amnesty International, which said he was exercising his right to free speech. Al-Namir is now awaiting his execution on death row. The fate of Sheikh Al-Nimr has troubled civil rights activists outside Saudi Arabia. Dozens staged their own protest on London's Downing Street, home to the British Prime Minister. Holding placards and banners, protesters call for Saudi Arabian authorities to halt his planned execution. Some 80 people have already been put to death in the country this year, and many fear the cleric may be running out of time. We spoke to organisers of the protest. Here's what they told us.
As everyone knows, there is no independent judiciary system in Saudi Arabia. Earlier, many human rights defenders have been attacked by the campaigns internationally. Somehow pressure over them been reduced. And I think the Sheikh Nimr should take more attention and we can make the change.
I think it's fundamental as citizens of the UK to voice our concerns about Saudi Arabia's gross human rights record, and also to tell the government that we think that their relationship with Saudi Arabia is unacceptable. The more we speak out, the more it will trickle up into the higher levels, and that's why we strategically chosen this location today outside the Prime Minister's office.
Greece may have found the solution to its financial problems with the EU. There was official confirmation Thursday that Russian Deputy Finance Minister Sergei Storchak has invited Greece to become the sixth member of the new development bank of the BRICS countries. That confirmation follows a report earlier in the week on Greece's Syriza Party's website. Storchak is a representative of the BRICS Bank, now being established. Moscow's invitation came as a pleasant surprise to Greece. That, according to a report in the Russian news agency Sputnik Thursday, citing a source in the Greek government who said that the country does not want to limit its foreign policy to the EU and Eurozone membership only, also noting that Greece's foreign policy is, quote, very diversified, close quote. According to the report, the unnamed source from the Greek government said, quote, we are members of the European Union and of the Eurozone, but at the same time we acknowledge that there are also other powers in the world, and we will make our decisions taking into account our own interests while fulfilling the commitments we have in other international organizations we are part of, closed quote. A summit was underway Thursday between the two largest members of the BRICS countries. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi arrived in China's ancient city of Xi'an Thursday, beginning a three-day visit to that country. Modi met with China's President Xi Jinping. It was his first official visit to China since he assumed office last May. Trade and security issues were expected to top the agenda. CCTV's Tian Wei has more.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is headed to Beijing this week. Ahead of the visit, he's already joined the Chinese social media platform Sina Weibo as a way to reach out to the Chinese people. He wrote in his Weibo, "Hello China, looking forward to interacting with Chinese friends through Weibo." He wrote that in his first post in Chinese language. It's all part of a major charm offensive as India hopes to foster a closer relationship with China. Our correspondent Shweta Bajaj reports from New Delhi.
Zhang Yang left his home near Beijing to study Buddhism in Delhi University 4 years back. He is currently pursuing a master's in philosophy, researching cultural exchanges between China and India. Zhang tells us every high-level visit and interaction between the two most populous nations in the world is an opportunity for a shared future.
I find it's a very positive way to communicate, to do cooperation between India and China. And it's also very important to understand each other. Then it will improve other aspect.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's China visit is being seen as one of the most important ones that he is taking during his first year as India's Prime Minister. While he is using social media and yoga to reach to Chinese people, the Indian Ministry of External Affairs says expect a range of serious issues to be discussed.
You may expect that a full range of political issues would be discussed, bilateral ties, regional issues, multilateral issues.
But trade will be top of the agenda, including ways to tackle the trade imbalance between China and India. India will also try and get more access for its pharmaceutical and IT services industry in the Chinese market.
On the trade side, we think it's completely conceivable that China imports more from India. There are many areas where India is globally competitive, but somehow we have not been able to be successful in the Chinese market. The solution to trade has to be found by more enlightened regulatory practices which would create a better trade balance.
China is India's largest trading partner with two-way trade totaling $70 billion. And with Modi's aim to give its people prosperity and a better life, this trip will also be about economy. But that doesn't mean that bilateral and diplomatic issues will be left behind. According to Indian Ministry of External Affairs, resolving border disputes, coordinating on multilateral forums, and increasing cultural exchanges will also be discussed. Deals on railways will also be on the table. Alka Acharya is the director of the Institute of Chinese Studies in New Delhi. She says there would be efforts by both nations to ensure that the visit is successful.
Modi would be looking for investment, for getting the trade imbalance rectified, for infrastructure development. So all these are going to also play a role. The third thing I think is also the larger picture that is unfolding in Asia. It has to do with how India and China are going to engage with each other. A lot of expectations are coming from the Asian countries about the foundations for this Asia century being laid by India and China.
Modi is starting his visit on a personal note from the ancient city of Xi'an in President Xi Jinping's home province. President Xi started his India visit with Modi's home state of Gujarat. But here in India, expectations are running high. The biggest challenge of this visit will be to discuss contentious issues while forging a deeper relationship. Shweta Bajaj, CCTV, New Delhi.
While the U.S. media focus on the Amtrak train that crashed Tuesday outside of Philadelphia targets the engineer who operated it at around 100 miles per hour, left out of the narrative entirely is the woeful condition of U.S. rails generally and the inability of the U.S. railway infrastructure to handle the demands of 21st century train traffic. Elsewhere in the world, public investment and public policy generally have supported the construction and operation of modern railroads. But in the U.S., such support has not been generally available. High-speed rail or commercial train service operating at the speed of 125 miles per hour or higher exists on only one line in the U.S. By that measure, China has the world's largest network with almost 10,000 miles of track in service as of December of last year, more than the rest of the world combined. China's high-speed rail system also includes the world's longest line, the 1,500-mile Beijing-Guangzhou high-speed railway. Investment in high-speed rail pays major dividends in added ridership. Since high-speed rail service was introduced in China in 2007, daily ridership grew from 237,000 that year to 2.49 million 7 years later in 2014, a more than tenfold increase. China's nationwide high-speed rail network consists mainly of conventional track railways with some upgraded mixed passenger and freight lines, newly built passenger designated lines, and intercity lines. Nearly all high-speed rail lines and rolling stock in China are owned and operated by the government through its China Railway Corporation. In the U.S., Amtrak's Northeast Corridor, the line where Tuesday's crash occurred, is the only high-speed rail line in operation in the country. It links Boston, New York City, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. A California high-speed rail project was planned to have its first operating segment between Fresno and Bakersfield in 2021. No other segment is expected to be in service in the U.S. before 2025. Elsewhere in the world, high-speed rail is common throughout Europe, and major projects are under development there, in Asia, and in South America. Agreement was reached late last year for a high-speed railroad linking Beijing to Moscow that would reduce the travel time between the two capitals from 6 days to 33 hours. And a transcontinental railroad is being built in South America by China and regional governments. This past weekend saw hundreds of activists gather in Secaucus, New Jersey, for a conference addressing the wars at home and abroad, sponsored by UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. Among the speakers was Clarence Thomas, a member of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. He's also the national co-chair of the Million Worker March movement.
Brothers and sisters, friends and comrades, I bring you greetings from the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local 10 in San Francisco.
All right.
After that compelling message and call by Brother Larry Ham, I'm almost at a loss for words. I had a 1 hour speech and only 7 minutes to give it, but we'll see what we can do. First thing is, I want to have people to join me in a chant. We've been sitting down for too long here today. It's going to be two chants, one of which is from Ferguson to Palestine, occupation is a crime. And the second one will be from Baltimore to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Let's do it. From Ferguson to Palestine, occupation is a crime. From Baltimore to Palestine, occupation is a crime. One more time. From Ferguson to Palestine, occupation is a crime. From Baltimore to Palestine, occupation is a crime. All right. Whoever was sleeping or thinking about it, they're awake now. I want to depart from the topic that's been told for us to present today, because I don't believe in redundancy. I got a lot on my mind, and I can cite you statistics about how 15 neighborhoods in West Baltimore have a life expectancies of babies is to be 64 years of age, compared to white segments of Baltimore where the life expectancy of a baby is 84. But I don't want to talk about that. You can read that on Google or anything else. What I want to talk about is what it means to the working class to be faced with these attacks. And how do we respond? That's only logical. I don't want anyone to misunderstand me when I say this. Rallies are very important. I was at the Million Man March in 1995, where some 2 million black men amassed in Washington, D.C. We organized the Million Worker March in 2004. In opposition to the Democratic Party and the officialdom of labor. I was at the 10th anniversary of the Million Man March in Washington, D.C. My wife and I attended the Million Woman's March in Philadelphia. Marches and rallies are important, but what makes them more significant is when there is action taken at the point of production by American workers. You see, we have to remember what George Bush told us. He says, I don't care how many people come out to a rally. That's just a focus group. There were millions of us that hit the streets protesting the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. But until such time as we do things to cut off the money, interrupt commerce, which is why I am so proud of our young people who've made the call for no business as usual.
That's right.
This is coming from a sector of the working class that is not part of organized labor. The fastest growing sector of the working class today is black and brown and immigrant workers who are underemployed or unemployed.
Walter Scott, who was shot in the back in North Charleston, was a worker. Just because he was unemployed doesn't change anything. When Walter Scott was killed, we learned that his brother was a member of Local 1422 in Charleston, South Carolina, one of the most powerful labor organizations in the entire right to work for less state of South Carolina. Why is that important? It's important because longshore workers are some of the most important workers in the global economy. That computer that you have in front of you, those tennis shoes that you're wearing, the cars that you drive, all come off of a ship. And we are the ones who handle that cargo. And I'm so proud to stand up before you today to say that for over 80 years, my union, the ILWU, has been in the vanguard of all of organized labor in terms of taking positions on economic and social justice matters. Whether or not it was in 1935 when Italy invaded Ethiopia, there was a community blockade to stop a ship from being loaded full of metals and nickel on its way to Italy. Whether or not it was in 1939, whether 1 minute and 1 minute equals to two. Whether or not it was 1939, after Japan had invaded Manchuria, there was a blockade to stop the shipment of scrap iron to Japan. We've been on the front lines for a long time, and it ain't stopped. When Nelson Mandela got out of prison, he made a worldwide tour. And when he spoke in Oakland, he thanked the ILWU for 11 days refusing to handle South African cargo. But it ain't stopped there. We shut down 29 ports calling for justice for Mumia Abu-Jamal in 1999. But it did not stop there. Fast forward to 2010, after Israelis, commandos killed those people from Turkey, taking humanitarian supplies. We shut down an Israeli vessel for 24 hours, the first time in American history that labor's taken a position on the question of Palestine. I'm gonna wrap it up, but not before I say this. On May 1st, 2015, on International Workers' Day, ILWU Local 10, not in protest, but in opposition and resistance to the terror which is going on amongst our people all across the United States of America, shut down 5 Bay Area ports. And I want to know this. Where is the rest of the working class? When we shut down the port, we shut down the port at great risk. Right now, there are delegations going to Washington, D.C. to put longshore workers on the West Coast under the Railroad Workers Act so we cannot strike. Are you going to let them isolate us? Every port in the United States of America should have been shut down. If you want to end police murder, if you want to end any economic inequality, if you want to end segregation, if you want to end oppression and racism, you have got to shut down capitalism. We need to be strategic. We need to understand that's what time it is. An injury to one is an injury to all. Thank you very much.
Also presenting at the UNAC conference was Kevin Zeese from Popular Resistance.
Well, greetings from Baltimore. We just experienced the test run of martial law. They know the revolt is coming, or coming quickly. And this urban uprising in Baltimore was a great thing to be part of and to follow the lead of incredible young organizers who are doing a great job. Before I get into my talk, I want to say thank you to the people who organized this conference at UNAC. It's great to see such a great mix of issues, people, organizations. This is the kind of thing that builds the kind of movement of movements we need to really build power. So thank you all, and I hope everyone gives them a round of applause to the organizers at UNAC for this great, great job. I want to talk about the deepness of the problems we face. That's our war culture. War culture that goes back before the founding of this country to the colonizers who first came and who developed what's still used today as the American way of war. It's a way of war that is one that is unlimited, that targets civilians, that undermines the basic necessities for people to survive, like food, that will use disease to kill, that will use any method of operation to achieve their brutal end. And it's a method of war we still use today around the world, and now we're seeing it's being used in the United States. It's been used here for a long time. We're now just starting to see it. In Baltimore, you know, we see a very divided city. The east and west sides of Baltimore are poor, African-American primarily, denied basic services, denied education that's adequate. Schools are being closed, rec centers being closed, fire stations are being closed. They can't even get healthy food in those neighborhoods. It is classic, you know, American warfare. Take away from people what they need to survive. Undermine their feeling that they can fight back. You know, break these communities. And then enforce that with brutal occupation. And we saw that occupation nationally, and the whole country got to see it last week. But it's been happening for years. This is not a new thing in Baltimore. In fact, one of the presidential candidates who no one here should vote for is our former mayor, Martin O'Malley, who, when he was mayor, built his career on looking tough on crime by arresting 1/6 of the population in 1 year. He arrested tens of thousands of young African-American, mainly males, for no reason. And I mean no reason. They were held overnight in jail, and released the next day with no charges. They were forced to sign a waiver of their right to challenge the false arrest, or threatened with, you'll have an arrest record, good luck getting a job. Imagine what that guy would do as he's commander-in-chief. We can't allow that to happen. That guy should not be anyone. People should be out protesting whenever he shows up anywhere. In fact, you know, he was sued, by the way, for that, and his police were as well, and it was a $850,000 settlement for their roundup policing without probable cause. And that still is how the police operate today. They still arrest and harass people for no reason. Freddie Gray is an example. There was no reason to chase him. There was no reason to search him. There was no reason to arrest him. And yet that's what happened. And unfortunately, as much as I admire our state's attorney for bringing charges so quickly, that was a great thing. But there's some things people should think about a little bit. The three van drivers, African-Americans, the three arresting officers were all white. The most serious charges went to the van drivers, the less serious charges to the arresting officers, and the arresting officers were, witnesses told the media, they saw them brutalizing Gray. They saw them with their knee on his back, with him being turned into a pretzel, with him being put into a hog tie with a knee on his back. That's how he fractured his neck. You could see it when he's walking to the police van. And yet that wasn't mentioned by Mosby. Why was that? And that's going to be the linchpin of the acquittal, because they will divide the two police camps, the van and the arrestees. They'll be tried separately. The van's defense lawyers will say, here's a witness who says he was beaten. Here's a witness who said knee on his neck. Here's one who said pretzel. Here's one hogtied. Here's videos of him trying to get in the van. It wasn't the driver. Our experts say that the rough van ride's not enough to break his neck. acquittal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.